Today, the fallout continues. The DFA Daily to the 7th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to his post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's digest, we look at why the latest US job data may be wrong, China's latest warning, and how the home builder programme is being spruiked. And by the way, I think several of you missed the irony in yesterday's title about relaxing, everything is fine. Truth is, the markets may be pricing so, but the real world is a long way off normal. And it won't be back to normal for, let's say, half a decade or so, if we're lucky. But first, a massive $440 million housing stimulus package has been unveiled for WA to help bring the economy out of the COVID-19 hibernation and boost the construction sector. The scheme, which will create about 4,300 direct jobs, sees the McGowan government's total amount of relief measures increase to $2.3 billion. The Sunday Times revealed this morning that part of the new package would be a $117 million building bonus program, but the McGowan government has now unveiled the full scope by announcing an additional $319 million social housing scheme. The social housing recovery package will see 1,500 homes refurbished and the construction of 250 new dwellings, and there will also be a regional maintenance program for 3,800 homes. The building bonus package will offer up to $20,000 grants for West Australians looking to build a new home, which will be additional to the federal government's $25,000 home builder payment, meaning some home builders will be eligible for up to $45,000 in government grants. A further $8.2 million has also been allocated to expand the 75% off the plan transfer duty rebate of up to $25,000 for purchases of units in multi-tiered developments under construction. Mark McGowan pulled out some Pulp Fiction-esque rhetoric when making the announcement today about shepherding the housing sector away from an economic valley of death. This is designed to create jobs, to get confidence back, to make sure we get all those apprentices back on the job, the Premier said, to make sure the housing sector doesn't go into a valley of death at some point in the future. Mr. McGowan said there was never a better time to build with low interest and other factors providing incentives for getting into the market. And the Premier said he would write to every local government in Western Australia this week calling on red tape to be cut and approvals expedited to get homes under construction as soon as possible. Mr. McGowan said building grants would be accessible to foreign, interstate and local investors. And he said few contracts for new homes had been signed in the past few months, and something needed to be done to save 60,000 jobs in the industry. Federal Finance Minister Matthias Cormann said between national and WA government programs, a first home buyer in the state could have access to nearly $70,000 of support, taking into account the $10,000 first home owner's grant. The housing industry has lauded the new package, with Master Builder WA Executive Director John Glavis saying the sector had been looking into a deep hole. A survey of Master Builders WA members in April indicated more than 70% of our members reported a 40% decline in their pipeline of work, he said. This was extremely worrying because when you add on the 3 to 4 month construction time, it became clear the industry was set to fall off a cliff around August. And Property Council WA Executive Director Sandra Brewer said thousands of jobs would be saved because of the package. Now, of course, the only point there is that prices will rise by the amount of the extra money, so it's a zero-sum game. According to the SMH, real estate agents in outer suburbs have been flooded with calls about the Morrison government's home builder grant for new homes and renovations, but major industry groups warn many people will fail to qualify unless the scheme is expanded and normal processes are suspended. Liverpool-based realtor Dean Brofskick said he took 70 calls in 24 hours and had probably 8 buyers telling me they are ready to buy, they are ready to utilise the grant straight away. And Master Builders Australian boss Denita Wan warned governments may need to exempt applicants from the program's rules unless banks and councils speed up loans and development approvals. HomeBuilder is deliberately targeted to kickstart building activity over the next months, when the viability of small builders and the security of jobs will be under most threat. This is what the industry asked for, she said. But the banks need to speed up lending, and state and especially local governments play their role and speed up approvals. Where there are intractable issues, the federal government should consider exemptions. And buyers are eligible for the $25,000 subsidy announced last week if they sign a building contract on a new home by the end of the year. The $750,000 limit on the property value makes it a perfect fit for home and land packages in the outer suburbs of major cities. But Tom Forrest, chief executive of the Urban Task Force, which represents property developers, said the scheme would have limited use in Sydney, where fewer packages were available under $750,000. If I was to be cynical, I'd say it seems to be directly targeted at Queanbeyan, he said, referring to the New South Wales town in the seat of Eden Monaro, where there will be a by-election on July the 4th. The price range is right for there, which was where it was launched. It's a good start, but it doesn't really apply for Sydney, and Sydney is the driver of the whole economy. Mr. Forrest told the Sun Herald and the Sunday Age the government needed to do three things: extend the time frame, have a look at the threshold, and make it apply to all new homes. The scheme is estimated to cost $688 million, but is uncapped, meaning anyone who qualifies will receive the grant. And there is also a renovation component. Homeowners can claim $25,000 towards a renovation or knockdown rebuild if their property's current value is below $1.5 million and they spend between $150,000 and $750,000 on the job. The government expects the grants to fund 20,000 new home builds and 7,000 renovations, and the package aims to stimulate the construction industry amid the coronavirus-induced recession. Assistant Treasurer Michael Sukkar said the federal government would work with the states to make the delivery of HomeBuilder as seamless as possible to achieve this objective. Applicants must sign a building contract by December the 31st, and construction must start within 3 months of signing. But critics say the tight timeframe meant many people who qualify would have been planning to undertake the projects anyway, and real estate agents in the outer suburbs of major cities were inundated with calls from prospective applicants last week. The Grattan Institute's Finance Program Director, Brendan Coates, said the benefits of the new build scheme would mostly flow to outer suburban areas and maybe some areas in the middle suburbs. For the smaller renovation scheme, you are looking at renovations in the inner or middle rings of major cities. Mr. Coates said the people who would really benefit from the home builder scheme were retirees. Some of them are going to look to downsize, and they could use it to pay for a 2 or 3 bedroom unit in the centre of our cities and buy that new, he said. And Ken Richardson, Managing Director of Newcastle's Build Smart Constructions, which also does designs, welcomed the scheme, but doubted it would generate any new developments. "We have a lot of people ready to kick their projects off. I've told them straight away that there's a slim chance of us getting this to contract in time," he said. Lead time between conception and signing contracts is usually at least 6 months for a custom build of any kind. It's a bit of a short turnaround for anyone to do home renovations unless they were going to do them anyway. And Mick Phillips of Bell Property in Charleston near Newcastle said the package was poorly constructed and rushed through. "Applications usually took many months to get council approval," he said, while homeowners who could afford a $150,000 renovation in his region would likely have household income above $200,000, making them ineligible. And you can see that this may provide some marginal momentum in the building sector, but I think the scheme is still full of holes. Now more on those US employment numbers, which boosted the market on Friday. The official 13.3% unemployment rate, which still was high relative to any point since the Great Depression in the early 20th century, likely understates the economic damage wrought by the coronavirus pandemic. The real unemployment rate is likely to be at least 16%, according to the federal government. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which published its monthly jobs report on Friday morning, admitted the official unemployment rate may be low relative to reality due to an error in data collection. Around 21 million Americans were unemployed as of mid-May, a reduction of 2.1 million people from a month earlier. According to BLS data, that number includes workers who were furloughed, meaning those who were temporarily laid off by their companies in recent weeks. And more than 15 million workers, around 73% of the total unemployed, are on temporary layoff and expected to be recalled to work once business rebounds. That share is far higher than any other time in modern history, with the exception of April, when the share was 78.3%. Yet the BLS may have severely undercounted the number of workers classified as unemployed on temporary layoff due to an error, the agency said. The BLS determines how many people are unemployed based on a household survey. Survey interviewers misclassified several furloughed workers as being absent from work due to other reasons, according to the BLS. That's the same category of workers who'd be on vacation, for example. The overall unemployment rate would have been about 3 percentage points higher than reported if those individuals had been identified correctly, according to the agency. And the estimate, by the way, isn't seasonally adjusted. That would put the official unemployment rate at 16.3%, and the true rate could be higher still. The unemployment rate doesn't include the share of workers who may have dropped out of the workforce, perhaps due to feeling pessimistic about the chances of finding a job in the current economy. More than 6 million workers have dropped out of the labour force since February. In fact, the unemployment rate is a much higher 21.2%, as judged by another metric. This metric, which the BLS calls U6, includes people marginally attached to the labour force. These are people who aren't currently working or looking for work, but are available for work, as well as part-time employees who want and are available for full-time work, but have had to settle for part-time employment. The U6 metric doesn't include the workers misclassified by the agency. Of course, furloughed workers could be recalled back to work quickly, depending on the speed of the economic rebound as states begin to reopen certain business sectors. And the unemployment rate would likely rebound faster in this eventuality than if the layoffs were permanent. The same misclassification phenomenon occurred in April too. The official 14.7% unemployment rate would have been nearly 20%. If furloughed workers had been identified correctly, the BLS said. BLS and the Census Bureau are investigating why this misclassification error continues to occur and are taking additional steps to address the issue, the agency said on Friday in the jobs report. According to usual practice, the data from the household survey are accepted as recorded, the agency said. To maintain data integrity, no ad hoc actions are taken to reclassify survey responses. But more examples of damn lies and statistics. I wonder what the market will do on Monday. The Australian government has disputed advice issued to Chinese citizens urging them not to travel to Australia amid what China calls a spike in racism during the coronavirus pandemic. The Chinese Ministry of Culture and Tourism issued the alert, reporting a significant increase in racist attacks on Chinese and Asian people. The warning came after China's state-run tabloid Global Times published an editorial that told Chinese students to be cautious about studying in Australia. Due to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, racial discrimination and violence against Chinese and Asian people in Australia has seen a significant increase, the ministry statement said. The Ministry of Culture and Tourism reminds Chinese tourists to enhance their safety awareness and do not travel to Australia. But Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack rejected the suggestion that there had been an increase in racist attacks in Australia. there hasn't been a wave of outbreaks of violence against Chinese people, he said. I don't know why this has been stated. I don't know what was in the thinking of the organisation or the person who made the statement. All I can say is the statement is not true. There have been numerous reports of people of Asian appearance experiencing flagrant racism across Australia in the wake of COVID-19. During the height of the pandemic, the ABC chronicled the stories of Asian Australians who had fallen victim to such attacks. A Chinese Australian family's Melbourne home was targeted by vandals 3 times in 1 week in April. And some of the incidents that happened in public areas were captured on video and shared widely on social media. But Australian Tourism Minister Simon Birmingham said the Chinese government's claims were false. We reject China's assertions in these statements, which have no basis in fact, he said. Australia is enjoying world-leading success in suppressing the spread of COVID-19, and when the health advice allows, we look forward to again welcoming visitors from all backgrounds to our safe and hospitable nation. Australia is the most successful multicultural and migrant society in the world. The Chinese-Australian community is a significant and valued contributor to that success story. Asked whether he was concerned China's decision could damage relations with Australia, opposition leader Anthony Albanese said he wanted to send a positive message. What I want is for everyone to know, regardless of where they are anywhere in the world, that Australia's a great place to visit, he said. Thousands of Chinese Australians have taken to social media platforms to discuss the claims. On popular Chinese social media platform Weibo, users expressed their concerns with one, what happened? No tourists allowed in except Australian citizens and residents. Not to mention there are no air tickets to purchase. Only tyrants can afford air tickets now. Since the announcement was made, hundreds of Chinese Australians said they also received questions from their friends and families in China asking if racism was really a problem in Australia. The discussion soon became a hot topic on the social media platform rSteps, attracting hundreds of comments. Some users said they had been treated very well. One user said, "My parents are here for more than half a year. Fortunately, they saw here that their neighbours were very friendly with them. If they saw news about discrimination in Australia, they would definitely be very, very worried about our safety in Australia." The travel warning from China could further sour relations between the trade partners. Last month, China announced an 80% tariff on Australian barley and blacklisted 4 major beef exporters due to labelling violations. But Beijing denied that the measures were in retaliation to Australia's call for an independent investigation into the global pandemic. And on Friday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison rejected claims that Australia's tightening of overseas investment security tests was made with China in mind. Mr. Morrison and Treasurer Josh Frydenberg revealed reforms into foreign investment that would include a stringent security test aimed at protecting critical assets. Mr. Morrison denied that the move was targeting China, adding that it should not further sour Australia's relationship with the world's most populous nation. "I don't believe it should," he said. "Countries make decisions on their own interests for their own rules, and we respect the rules and interests of other countries, so I see no reason why that should be the case. Australia will always design its foreign investment rules on that basis, as other countries do theirs, so I don't think there is anything extraordinary about that." The latest developments will put further pressure on cash-strapped Australian universities and colleges, which are reeling in the wake of coronavirus travel restrictions. Though I think this is the thin end of the wedge and a further illustration of the rising tensions between China and Australia. Next, the IMF came out with a bold statement this week called the Great Reset. In remarks to the World Economic Forum, Kristalina Georgieva, managing director from the IMF, said, "Now is the time to think of what history would say about this crisis. And now is the time for all of us to define our own role. Will historians look back and say this was the moment of a great reversal? Today, we see very worrying signs. 170 countries are going to finish this year with a smaller economy than at the start of the year. And we already projected that there will be more debt, bigger deficits, and more unemployment. And there is a very high risk of more inequality and more poverty unless we act. So what would it take for historians to look back at this crisis as a moment of a great reset? From the perspective of the IMF, we have seen a massive injection of fiscal stimulus to help countries deal with their crisis and to shift gears for growth to return. It is of paramount importance that this growth should lead to a greener, smarter, fairer world in the future. It is possible to do this, provided that we concentrate on the key elements of a recovery and act now. We don't need to wait. At the IMF, we see some tremendous opportunities. First, let me talk about green growth. Governments can put in place public investments and incentives for private investments that support low carbon and climate resilient growth. Many of these investments can lead to a job-rich recovery. Think of planting mangroves, land restoration, reforestation, or insulating buildings. Think of the key sectors for reducing carbon intensity, where both the public and private sector can invest. And I'm particularly keen to take advantage of the low oil prices that we see today to eliminate harmful subsidies and introduce a carbon price that would work as an incentive for future investments. Second, let me talk about smarter growth, she said. We know the digital economy is the big winner of this crisis, but we must not allow the digital divide to widen so that some countries and communities fall further behind. This would bring more pain than gain in the future. So it's critical that institutions like the IMF support investments that will shrink the digital divide, working in partnership with the World Bank and others. And we also need to think carefully about how to make sure the jump in growth and profitability in the digital sector leads to benefits that are shared across our societies. And that takes me, she said, to my third point, fairer growth. We know that if left to its own devices, this pandemic is going to deepen inequality. That has happened in prior pandemics, and we can avoid this if we concentrate on investing in people, in the social fabric of our societies, in access to opportunities, in education for all, and in the expansion of social programs so we take care of the most vulnerable people. Then we can have a world that is better for everyone. And she said, I want to include with an example from the past. William Beveridge, in the midst of the Second World War, put forward his famous report in 1942, in which he projected how the UK should address what he called the five giant evils. That famous Beveridge report led to a better country after the war, including the creation of the National Health Service that is saving so many lives today in the UK. So she said, now is the moment to step up and use all the strength we have to turn the page. In the case of the IMF, we have a $1 trillion financial capacity and tremendous engagement on the policy side. This is the moment to decide that history will look back on this as the Great Reset, not the Great Reversal. And I want to say loud and clear, the best memorial we can build to those who have lost their lives in the pandemic is to build a world that is greener, smarter, and fairer. To which I reply, well said, but in an era of rising international tensions and powerful, if mercurial, egos, how likely is it that such aspirations can be realised? Frankly, I have my doubts, but I think we should try. And finally, a quick reminder, my guest on DFA's live Q&A stream on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time will be Tony LeCantro from Aalto Capital. As an investment manager, Tony's view of the markets should prove interesting, to say nothing of his wider views of the economy. You can ask a question live on the YouTube chat or send them in beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are below. I look forward to seeing you on Tuesday. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.